Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Good day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 174 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
Right, so what have we been doing of late?
Just before the... I know it's not strictly Doc... Well, it's not Doctor Who related in any way whatsoever, but the comic book artist Kevin O'Neill passed away. I only just heard about it like an hour or two ago. I literally grew up with his comic strips that he had in 2000 AD, Nemesis the Warlock and the likes, and Metalzoic later on. And then he went on to do Martial Law with Pat Mills and loads of brilliant stuff, and The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen with Alan Moore. So yeah, a brilliant artist, very unique talent and very individual style. And, anyway, he passed away. Just mentioning, because we do quite often mention 2000 AD stuff on here, and I just wanted to tip my hat to him.
When you told us about half an hour ago, I was just looking up his history on Wikipedia. At the age of 16, he started as an office boy for the kids' comic Buster, which I used to get in the mid-70s. And he moved on to things like Monster Fun and Wizard and Chips, both of which are... So there was some chips I used to get. Yeah, I used to get Monster Fun. And then on to 2000 AD.
Yeah, where he, I believe he pioneered the credits card boxes, didn't he? Which told you exactly who wrote and who drew and even who lettered each of the individual stories. Because I think up until that point, that was very rare in the comics industry, certainly in this country. Mm. So for any of the creators to get any credit whatsoever, so... That was a bit of a game changer. And to be honest, it may well have led to the decimation of the British comics industry as all the finest talent was easily identified and snapped up by the big American publishers. So,
well, I have nothing within this house that I think is related to Kevin O'Neill, but I have worn, as a homage, the closest homage I could produce, a Beano t-shirt tonight, so... I don't know whether he worked on a Beano, but that's the closest I could get out of things in.
Don't think so.
Ah, okay, that's futile. Then might as well have just got a picture of Sean Connery signed by Roger Moore. There you go. I'm trying to think whether there's been much happening.
There's some news, isn't there, today?
That's probably the big one, isn't it, really? And that ties into some of the news that we've not spoken about yet as well with Disney Plus.
Yeah.
I think, actually, do you want me to read it out, or should I just read the gist?
I'll read it out. I mean, we've already heard, haven't we, a week or so ago, that Disney Plus is going to become the new home outside the UK for upcoming Doctor Who. And they left it at that, didn't they? But gradually, more and more rumours have been coming out, and Hayden found this article online today.
Yeah, it was from Broadcast Now, so the text is as follows. A new report from UK TV industry press site Broadcast claims that the BBC's recent deal with Disney, granting the House of Mouse worldwide streaming rights to the series outside of the UK and Ireland from 2023 onwards, could see Doctor Who's budget raised from its current approximate of $1.1 to $3.4 million per episode to approximately $11.5 million per episode, when filming begins for the show's 14th season, starring Shooty Gatwa as the 15th Doctor. Sources speaking to the Broadcast allege that the budget increase is a play to bring Doctor Who to more mainstream audiences again, now that it is competing in an age of lavish genre TV productions backed by powerhouses like HBO, Netflix and Amazon. While not reaching the giddy heights of budgets for recent series like House of the Dragon, which purportedly cost around $20 million per episode, Lord of the Rings The Rings of Power, which was an eye-watering $50 to $80 million per episode, or the fourth season of Stranger Things, which was $30 million per episode, it marks a major financial boost for a show that has long been defined by its budgetary constraints. Further plans could also see Doctor Who reattempt to spin off into a franchise of multiple shows, akin to returning showrunner Russ T. Davies' previous attempts with series like Torchwood and the Sarah Jane Adventures. What's not mentioned in broadcast reports is if this financial injection from Disney comes with any creative control for the mega studio, as previously claimed in reports from British newspaper The Telegraph. And this is a quote. The BBC had to make the decision for the future success of Doctor Who because any show of scale needs a partner, one undisclosed source told Broadcast. Oh dear. Reliability is the most important factor irrespective of how many episodes you make or who the Doctor is. If you can bring in a single partner with one distribution agreement while retaining exclusivity in the UK, this is the best of both worlds for the BBC. Doctor Who will return for a... We don't really need to know the rest of that bit. But yeah, that's interesting. So I think that was the first question which leaped into my head when I heard that Disney Plus were going to be distributing the show is, what kind of money are they going to pump into the programme, and are they going to have any creative control as well?
Well, I guess they wouldn't want something that looked budgetarily out of place on their screen as a new TV series appearing. Obviously, it probably doesn't matter so much for old series if they want to reshow those, but it would possibly stick out like a sore thumb amongst all the big-hitting Marvel programmes.
Would it, though? Because isn't one thing that people have been saying about Jodie's era being that it's never looked cinematically better?
Mm.
Could it look better? Unless it's something like, you know, paying to film on the other side of the world or something.
Well, this is something that popped into my head. Maybe something like budget expansion in that on that scale could also lead to maybe higher profile actors guest appearing or appearing in the show. Because, yeah, I think it's looked pretty damn good, actually, over the last few years.
Yeah, that's one of the things that you've not been able to complain. I mean, occasionally some of the CGI, which you'll always get with CGI done on a budget, some of it looks a little bit ropey occasionally.
Mm.
Those pictures of the Master's face, those paintings, for instance. I don't know if they were intentionally supposed to be quite that funny. But we'll discuss that later.
Mm. What do we think to it, though?
I suppose it depends what you mean by higher-profile actors, because higher-profile doesn't mean better, does it? I mean, you've had people like Eccleston and Capaldi doing it. Mm. I don't imagine were demanding a fortune.
Mm.
Certainly, I suppose that Capaldi was paid more than Eccleston. But there you are getting top-range actors. But I wonder if they buy, you know, higher-profile actors, you think of someone like, we want someone like, I don't know, a top Hollywood... I mean, there aren't really that many British actors that would demand that, are they? It's mostly going to be actors in Hollywood that would demand...
Yeah, this is the thing, isn't it?
The huge sums, isn't it? Which is what worries me. After all it took to partially reprieve the flux was Kevin McNally, and I doubt that he cost a great deal in actors' fees.
Do you remember, I think it was at the end of The Woman Who Fell to Earth, when they had... coming up in this series, and there were loads of people who were like guest appearing, and like one or two of them made household names, the rest of them just, you know, didn't know from Adam. I'm thinking more along those lines. If they were to do that again, maybe there'll be like Anthony Hopkins or Florence Pugh, or do you know what I mean? Like people who are going to, you know, demand a bit more of that. Could be that, perhaps.
Yeah, but we've had like Timothy Dalton as Rassilon and things like that, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
We've gone fairly big. We've had Richard E. Grant in there as well, you know.
Ian McKellen as the snowman, yeah.
I'm trying to think of what top British actors, I mean, I suppose, apart from, obviously there's like Dominic Cumberbatch and Ben Whishaw, I suppose, Rory Kinnear, you know, that's the like top tier, isn't it, really?
Maybe Phoebe Waller-Bridge, yeah.
Yeah, I can't see those people come to it. But that budget could be stretched all over the place. Well, it'll be stretched all over the place, won't it? Or spread all over the place. So you get better writers, you get better costumes, you get better monster effects, better, you know, all sorts of things.
Better sets.
Well, and I'll say again, better writers.
Is there anything in the sets or the costumes at the moment that you think, oh, that could be better if a few more million were spent on it?
Yeah, the TARDIS set.
Well, that's more because I don't like it rather than it looks cheap. It's just I don't really like that set. But you know what? That, along with several other things that we might mention later, are on their way out.
As a point, isn't it? It doesn't look cheap at the moment. And I certainly agree, if they could use that extra money to pay for people who could act and write, it would be a great improvement. But it worries me that if you've, let's say it's currently, what was that average, about between 1 and 3 million per episode to up to 11 million per episode. Now that's about 7 or 8 million that effectively is being funded by the audience that Disney plans to bring to it. Which makes you think, how much control are they expecting on that?
Hmm.
Are they going to want to start bringing in the sort of people from Hollywood who would command an eye-watering amount of money, but it would just be totally inappropriate for Doctor Who?
Yeah, I suspect that this is... Well, obviously, this must have been in the pipeline for a long time with Bad Wolf Productions, which is why Russell T. Davies is back on board, isn't it, I think? It's all becoming more and more... Because when he came back, I thought, well, that's wild. Why would he do... He must love the show. It's just like... It's just come back just because he loves it. And maybe there is a bit of that. But now also, the more we're hearing about this Disney deal, the more you're thinking, like his production company that he owns dealing with Disney Plus and stuff. It's like, you know, it's starting to make a lot more sense.
So it does concern me a little. I mean, the whole point of the show, in a way, has been that what are you able to do with imagination to replace a huge budget?
There's an element of it for me which feels a bit like, you know, when Newcastle were taken over lately.
Yes.
Well, in the last year, and then all of a sudden they're mega bucks and they've pushed their way past several teams, and you kind of hate them for it, especially for the reason where they've got that money from, and they're only going to be up there. Like, yeah, they can end up dominating for years, like a la Manchester City. It does feel a little bit like that, but I think it is genuinely the way of telly. I mean, there was an interesting talk which Russell T. Davies gave about 3 or 4 years ago, I think, at a Radio Times event, where he was talking about how this government is effectively going to ruin the BBC, and there's nothing we can do to stop it.
Mm.
And I was reminded of that when I saw about the Disney Plus deal. I've heard other podcasters, and I know we shouldn't talk about other podcasters and their opinions, but I mean, I don't think they kind of understand really what the BBC does over here. I think they all think it's a bit ludicrous, or some people seem to think it's a bit ludicrous that we pay a fee towards the license, but it's what you get for that, and it's the way that it's spread across so much. It's TV, radio, it's interactive, it's, you know, all the rest of it.
I've just seen someone on Facebook saying, well, if the BBC can do this with Doctor Who, then why do we need the license fee? They can do it with all their shows, can't they? Well, obviously they can't. Unless want the BBC just to become a string of high-budget drama series. But there's so much other it provides, and I think it's almost... I think it's almost a kick in the teeth for the idea of public service broadcasting, that you can only achieve this if we have multi-millions taken in from Disney. It would console me if we were told, and a result of that, people are going to end up with something like a 13-episode season, which, I mean, they get even more episodes a season for really big books, stuff like that in the States. But if it comes back and says, and the new season of Doctor Who will have 6 episodes. And you think, where the hell is all that money going? All right, admittedly, 20 million per episode is far less for 6 episodes than it is for 13 episodes. It's a cumulative sum. But I feel slightly more secure with someone like RTD at the helm. But then he's not going to be there forever, is he?
And he wasn't perfect first time round either, let's remember.
No.
I was going to say, to be honest, after the recent era, which I've not been able to attach myself to in the slightest, after every recent season and era up until Chris Chibnall took over, I've managed to kind of invest a piece of myself in it.
Yeah.
Even, you know, some of the less popular series. And I've still felt attached to it and still felt like my Doctor Who in a way, but I've kind of lost that attachment over this last era. So in a way, that's taken away my fear of what might happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead, I'm quite excited by the idea. I think my biggest worry is what might happen when the partnership comes to an end, which it will do, because nothing's forever. And that could be, what, 4 years, 8 years, 12 years? I don't know. But I can't see it. Is it really going to last that long?
It'll eventually be renegotiated, yeah.
And what happens then? Where do you go once you've been had all that money pumped into you, once you've been financially doped for years, to suddenly have your supply taken away from you?
You mean like Leeds United in the mid-noughties?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you end up in division whatever,
Yeah.
That's a worry. Whereas, like, perhaps middling Doctor Who could trundle along for another six decades. But maybe a superpowered Doctor Who might only last for a few years. So it may be a case of burning brightly for a few years rather than just sort of slowly fizzling out.
I hadn't thought of that because I was trying to be positive about it. But now I kind of think...
Oh, you always look so positive, Hayden.
I think it's sort of... Yeah, it's a very good point.
You see, I look at those things, those things you're reading out, Hayden.
Yeah.
House of the Dragon purportedly cost $20 million an episode.
Mm.
The Rings of Power, $50 to $80 million an episode. Stranger Things, $30 million an episode. Have any of you watched either of those series?
Stranger Things.
Yeah, Stranger Things, yeah. I've seen Stranger Things.
You see, I watched Rings of Power.
No, but I'm not interested in Lord of the Rings.
No, but I am, and it was dreadful. It's absolutely dreadful. The acting, about halfway through the series, someone came on who's playing a character, and you first hear him from off camera. He obviously enters the room or something. He says, and I suddenly perked up thinking, oh, so that's someone who can act. And it looks gorgeous. But it's shit. The writing is dreadful. The acting is appalling. The characterization is almost non-existent. And when they say, oh, we're spending all these millions on it, they never put that money into paying for writers and actors. It's all for the things like the CGI. And that's where it all goes into. And that's not what Doctor Who's about. Yes, it would be great to look lovely. But if it's a choice between the current era, which has just ended, which to me is looks gorgeous, the content is crap, and looks ropey, but the content is amazing, which was something like, I don't know, Tom Baker's Golden Era, his first few seasons, for instance, then give me the latter any day.
I thought you were reading our reviews on iTunes, though.
Reviews on iTunes? What?
Oh, I know. I was as shocked and appalled as you were.
I mean, there's something I didn't like, which I suppose, in a way, it's none of our business, but how long it's in Australia, for instance, it's been on their version of the BBC, the ABC, and it's effectively been free to air. And the culture of Doctor Who in Australia is possibly one of the closest that it's been to the UK, in that it's something that's always been there at people's fingertips. And if you're a kid whose parents don't want to pay for a Disney subscription for a few months, you don't get to see the show, do you?
You know what I mean?
I mean, the ABC issued a press release, which was quite polite, saying, oh, we've really enjoyed doing this and good luck. I'd be thinking, you got a new mate coming along with more money, and you just stick your two fingers up and send it to us.
The tone I've seen online about it is, for overseas fans, a lot of people I've seen have just said, oh, that's all right, I've got Disney Plus, or at least I can still watch it. And it's like, it reminded me of, do you remember back during the dark days of COVID?
Yeah.
When people would say, oh, I'm all right, because I've had my jab. Or do you know what I mean? It's like, it's that sort of like that self-preservation.
I can work at home on my laptop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like that self-preservation sort of things coming through again, but you're thinking, well, hang on, in other countries there might not be people, especially during, you know, if we're having anything like a cost of living crisis like we are over here, you know, is anyone really going to be able to fork out an extra bit just to watch Doctor Who? I mean, I know there are ways of doing it, you know,
slightly illegal ways, chaps.
But also with, you know, you can like sign up for a subscription or like a trial period for like a month or a week or whatever, and then, but then that also depends on if people have the time to binge an entire series, if they've got kids or if they've got school or whatever, you know, it's all these variables to take into account. I mean, it may drive some people back to, you know, the pirate days of the pirates. Tim,
I mean, for example, I'm watching this new Star Wars thing, Andor, at the moment, which I've took out a Disney subscription, and once it stops, I'll cancel the subscription. So I'll only be having a subscription open for about 2 months, which isn't a fortune, but it's still money that not everyone can afford. And it does take me back to what we were saying, in fact, in the most recent podcast that's gone out, of what Matt was telling us about taking children around Media City in Salford, and they're just having no idea what the TARDIS or the Daleks was. I mean, I suppose they could use some of this extra money for, say, funding some of these spin-offs that they keep talking about, which presumably are not going to attract, or are unlikely to attract, as much of an audience as the main show itself. So, hope it goes well.
Yes, we could end up with a proper Doctor Who extended universe again.
Yeah.
All of them around the TARDIS console in a big finale.
I think when they say BBC maintains, what do they call it, which says creative control, that tends to mean we've got the copyright, so screw you if you think you're taking it over. They're not actually selling it.
Mm, what about if some of that money ended up in the animations? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, this is what I think will actually happen. I do think that will happen.
There aren't many left.
No, not many left, but we've heard rumours, haven't we, that there's one that is in production at the moment, so...
I'm wondering if they could be, like, completely new, like, animated Third Doctor adventures or something, like a series of those. That'd be pretty... Mm. Do you remember that kind of manga-esque Third Doctor one from a little while ago? That was, I mean, we could end up with stuff like that. I don't know. A lot of possibilities open up. There's a lot of... possible branches heading off into the future now that weren't there before.
Talking of things that have suddenly been sprung on us, what do we think of the new logo?
Do you mean the new old logo? Or the old new logo?
Oh.
The one they clearly ripped off Diddly Dum.
Yeah.
I think it looks gorgeous.
Mm. No, it looks brilliant. That was the logo when I was growing up that you'd see on all the videos.
Yeah.
So it has a nostalgic feel for me.
Yeah.
But it's a diamond logo for the diamond anniversary. So, I mean...
Oh, of course, yes.
The little tweaks they've done to it are lovely as well. They've just changed things. And it looks really three-dimensional. It really kind of pops out at you, doesn't it? And the colouring's very tastefully done. It's not just like the old red, blue and yellow just sort of stamped on there. It's really nicely done. And I think I've seen other things which were leaked beforehand, where like they can use it in like different variations, sometimes with just like in a straight line and stuff with Doctor Who and down and or sometimes without the diamond on it, but just the words and things. And it looks great. It's a marvelous logo. It's Bernard Lodge, am I right?
Yeah,
oh, that rings a bell.
Designed by Bernard Lodge. Yes, it's design classic, and it's just it's lovely to see it back again. It's not going to be used on the Blu-ray boxes, though, is it?
No, Blu-ray boxes are going to stay.
They're sticking with the Jodie era. So, like Hayden says, I think it will just be a diamond logo for diamond era.
Yeah.
So, are we watching anything interesting?
Funny you should mention that, Doc. Yes. I've been indulging recently in some classic 1950s TV. So, I've gone beyond Doctor Who, and I've decided to check out Quatermass and the Pit.
Ooh.
And the Peter Cushing, or I should say actually Nigel Neal version of 1984.
Ooh.
Yeah, both of them were affordable, I should say, on Amazon. So I took the plunge. I watched Quatermass first, and I was really impressed by it, actually, I have to say. It was a proper spooky story. I mean, I went into it thinking it was very science fiction, but actually it almost sort of turns out to be like a ghost story as well. It's like there's the paranormal going on in it. Have either of you ever seen it?
Do you know what? I don't think I've seen the BBC version, but I have seen the Hammer film version.
Right. Okay. There's a brilliant moment, I think it's the cliffhanger to episode 4, where basically there's an engineer inside the pit and he starts being attacked by something that's invisible. And there's an awful lot of rocks and all kinds of stuff sort of like floating around and pummeling him and hitting him. And he runs towards like a food trailer first, and then like the cutlery flies off the food trailer towards him. So then runs to the church. And when he runs to the church, he falls to the floor. And when the vicar sees him, comes outside, sees him, and then underneath his hat, like his face down in the gravel, and next to his hands, there's like snaking thing underneath the gravel that's making the gravel rise as it's moving through. And I found that genuinely spooky. I mean, this is something that was made, I think it was 58 or 59 it was made. So, you know, 65 years ago, nearly. And the fact that it was, most of it was done live, if it wasn't filmed on in, you know, 35mm inserts. I was really impressed by it. Really impressed. And 1984, even though it was only a few years older, could have been filmed like 10 years earlier. It was, in contrast, it was, I don't know whether it was as, I suppose it was equally as impressive as it was filmed live again. Just how well the execution of the serial comes across isn't obviously as advanced as Quatermass was by that point, but it's still impressive. I had no idea that Donald Pleasance was in it, and he popped up fairly early on with Peter Cushing, who is brilliant as Winston.
Horror royalty.
Oh, there we are, yeah. And I thought both were excellent, but I think Quatermass left more of an impact on me, I have to say. I think that was...
Tim from the Missing Episodes Doctor Who podcast has been recommending the BBC Quatermass and the Pit very highly. And you've obviously really enjoyed it, so I shall have to try and check it out.
Go for it. Highly recommended to everyone out there. Because it's one of those shows that people say influenced Doctor Who, isn't it? So I don't know whether I can see that so much, but it's...
Well, it sounds like it wouldn't be out of place in The Demons.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sort of thing it may have done, yeah.
You know, that SAS thing as well.
SAS Rogue Heroes, yeah, I've watched the first three episodes of that. I've really enjoyed it so far. What have you thought of that?
I thought it was okay. I binge-watched it one night.
Oh, you finished it?
That David Stirling, the kind of sort of semi-aristocratic guy who set it up. If you're impressed by him, I would recommend you don't check out his biog on Wikipedia. After the war, he created an organisation called Great Britain 75. I think I knew this already. Great Britain 75, and recruited people from, you know, like the gentlemen's clubs in St. James's and ex-military men to take over the running of government in the event of civil unrest. And he dropped that once he found out the nature of some of the people who were joining. And then in the mid-70s, he created a secret organisation to undermine trade unionism from within.
Oh.
To infiltrate trade unions to cause as much trouble during trade union conferences as possible. And you seem to think then, what a twat.
Yeah.
But there's been some... I've been watching this Andor, which is the latest Star Wars stuff. And it's getting better and better. The political stuff is really good. And they've got some decent actors on that. But I just stopped watching the fourth series of Star Trek Discovery. At the weekend. I just switched off about halfway through the third episode.
Oh, I lasted one episode more than you.
Because Star Trek is now, you know, it's become so dreadful.
Yeah.
It's just full. These ships are crewed by these simpering, giggling student fans, you could imagine they would be. You know, I don't mean that fans are writing the show. I mean that they've actually, as if they'd cast fans in the show and said, now behave as if you were fans. And they're dreadful. They're all smirking and giggling at each other. No, I'm so wacky. It just seems bizarre. Anyway, I got rid of that. There's very little on that. I mean, The Lord of the Rings was absolutely dreadful, which is why I went nowhere near House of the Dragon, just in case it was as bad. I did watch recently a series which is an adaptation of a Stephen King novel. What was that called? 11/22/63. Which is about this guy who goes back in time, ostensibly to try to stop the Kennedy assassination. Only he goes back to about 3 years before, so he's doing a lot of stuff leading up to it. And it's not all about Kenny. There's lots of just episodes about what he's doing otherwise in the early 60s. And the acting is just... It stands out so much against something like The Rings of Power. It's just effortlessly fine acting. Led by James Franco, which is another reason why you shouldn't search for people's biogs on Wikipedia. Or if you do, don't read the section in the menu that says personal scandals.
Oh,
yeah.
You watch anything, Mark?
I've been watching The Boys, actually, with a friend of mine, which I've really enjoyed. It's very puerile in places. If I was a teenage boy, I think I would believe this programme to be the greatest piece of art ever created, because it's just full of sex and gore and weird stuff going on with Two Girls Gone Bad. And it's got a mesmerising performance from Carl Urban, who's a Kiwi, it's taken me two seasons to work at, well, it took me until somebody actually confirmed in story that his character's from Britain before I could quite work out his accent, because he was got his wild weed lot of us. Well, that's a bit naughty, isn't it now? I'll go have a cup of tea. It's yeah. Love. Yeah, you wank bollocks and stuff like that.
But that's how the two of you sound to me.
What?
So standard Cockney accent. The old definition of a Cockney, of course, listeners, being someone who's born south of Stockport. Is this one where there's a character dressed almost in the American flag called Homelander?
Yes, yeah.
Yes. I was watching that earlier this year. I stopped watching because it was getting a bit too depressing. I get very easily depressed by shows, TV theaters. Oh, they're all being mean to each other. I'll stop watching it.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
As of my mother.
You ever watched Blake 7?
Oh, it's so bleak.
Well, actually, funny as you say, I love The Boys, but I kind of wish they'd finished it after two series, because...
I've not finished the third series yet.
I'm starting not to like any of them. That's... any of the supposed heroes and the villains.
Well, that was it. There's no one I liked. Or the ones I liked get killed by the ones I don't like. Mind you, that's my life, generally.
Well, I think that's the whole point, though, isn't it, really? A lot of modern shows do that. All these people are arses. It's like, oh, great.
So what else has been happening? There were some Jodie fanatics recently on social media bragging that Jodie has become the first Doctor since Tom Baker to have had three prime ministers during her era. And as impressive as that sounds, I think I'd rather not have replied, Shooty can claim to have three prime ministers since his casting was announced.
Yeah.
So, talking of the Jodie era, as we finally get around to it, we are, this podcast, reviewing Power of the Doctor. Would anyone like to start? Who commented on how they could predict that we'd review this? Who was it?
Oh, that was Tim, wasn't it?
I think it was Tim, yeah.
He suggested that Hayden would start off by being fairly positive about it, and then Doc would come in and say, now, I don't want to be negative, but... And then half an hour later, Hayden would be on the floor, depressed.
Well, I'll tell you what. We should buck the trend then and let Mark start with his opinion then.
Let me start. Right. Well, do you want to chat, shall we? I'm not going to go into massive detail, first of all. I'll just say what I thought about it and stuff, and then we'll see where we go from there. But
okay.
I thought, considering it's 90 minutes, or nearly 90 minutes, it's like the longest episode that Chris Chibnall's done, isn't it? And one of the longest episodes we've had. It felt surprisingly sprightly compared to, say, 40 minutes of episode 3 of The Flux or whatever. And again, I think it's one of those ones that I watched and I was cringing quite a lot early on. And then I kind of relaxed into it a bit, because I think early on, a feature Chris Chibnall sometimes is he likes to do these cold open scenes, doesn't he? Which he does sometimes. And I usually struggle with those, and they usually feel a bit sort of superfluous and a bit kind of a bit of a drag. And I had that feeling again. And then we got through the credits, and then we saw Ace and we saw Tegan. And I was like a bit, oh no, just it felt to me like they were, I feel really bad. I don't want to, I hate saying anything negative about either of them because, one, because Sophie's lovely. Sophie Aldridge is a genuinely lovely person. And secondly, Janet Fielding actually lives quite near me. I don't want to come around and kick my head in. So, but I thought they stood out quite badly with their acting style, I thought, early on. And that was, cringing again. And that line they deliver, that it still doesn't really make sense to me.
From the doctor for nearly 4 decades.
Yeah, all right, show off.
Just because it's only 3 decades for me.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
I know.
And the delivery of those lines, I think, and in fact, I think for pretty much all the time until about halfway through the episode, it took for me to get used to seeing them on screen and get used to their kind of delivery, because their delivery, I think, is slightly different to actors who've been, let's say, working in television regularly for a long time. I mean, Janet Fielding even said on her Twitter thing, somebody said, were you nervous when you went back to do it? And she said, gosh, yes, I haven't stood in front of a TV camera for over 30 years, you know. So, you know, fair play to her. But
their voices sounded very much, very, very like their acting voices in the 80s, didn't they? They didn't sound like... You know how Tom now sounds like someone who's in his 80s?
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I don't listen to Big Finish, so I don't know if they sounded like their Big Finish versions of themselves, but it did kind of stand out. It took a while for me to get used to it. And then I just kind of relaxed. I think about by the time we got halfway through the episode, I think I'd kind of got over all that. I'd relaxed into it, was kind of enjoying it. I'd got over the fact that the Master was Rasputin and that Rasputin now no longer existed. He was the Master all along. That irritated me because Rasputin's a fascinating character and I've read up quite a bit on him. I used to buy my daughter Polly, was a huge, I wouldn't say fan of Rasputin because he was an arsehole, but she was a...
fascinated by him.
She was fascinated by him and she had loads of books and I borrowed those and read them and it's really interesting. It irritates me a little bit to see. Say, oh, he's just, he was just a plan of the Master all along. He wasn't the real person. It's like, ah. So it got better for me as the episode went on. It wasn't dragging, saying the way that Legend of the Sea Devils seemed twice as long as this episode to me. And yet it's only half as long. And, yeah, the pace kept up. It rolled through. It got to the end bits and the end payoffs, which, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Jodie's last lines or anything, but in fact, I'll come back to Jodie in a minute. But, you know, seeing the David Tennant regeneration, Hayden predicted quite rightly what David Tennant's first words were going to be.
Yes.
Or how that episode would end, and you were absolutely right with the triple what. And then, obviously, I mean, you've got to love seeing the rest of the old companions there, or those ones that were there. I believe Annika Wills, who was Polly, was asked, but couldn't make it. Is that right?
She couldn't make it. Yeah,
she couldn't. Yeah, it was her and Tom Baker, apparently. But you don't know with Tom.
Well, Tom, yeah. But I'm not surprised about Tom, though. Have you seen recent photos of him?
It's very frail, isn't he?
Mm.
He looks tiny as well. And Tom Baker is a big man. You know, if you meet Tom Baker, he's met him in the 90s. He's a big fellow. You know, I've spoken before about shaking his hand. He's like, massive hands. He's just like, big and strong. You're a big fellow, big presence. And he's just, you know, and he's, because that's how, he's an old chap now. He's the oldest surviving doctor, isn't he? So,
88, yeah, and he's a good decade older than, I think the next oldest doctor is Colin Baker, who's 79, I think.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and then Colin looks his age, you know, maybe he doesn't look awful for his age, but he looks, you know.
Hmm.
So I'm not surprised Tom didn't do it. I don't think that would have been, I'm not sure that would have been what fans wanted to see. How did you feel about seeing William Russell on there? Because it was lovely to see him, but again, it's, shocking to see them looking so old, isn't it?
He's also 97 now.
He's only 3 years younger than the BBC itself.
Gosh.
Oh, yeah. But it's hard not to feel happy and warm. I mean, just that bit where Bradley Walsh is talking to the group, and you haven't seen any members of the group, but you can hear Katie Manning's laugh. And I don't know if they use the same clip of her laugh, but that laugh seems to crop up about three times in a minute. It sounds exactly the same. But yeah, Katie Manning's laugh there. And it just, as soon as you hear that, you're like, oh, they've got Katie Manning back. And then as it pulls out and you see, you know, Melanie Bush there as well. And Ian as well. That was really nice to see Ian. Yeah. That was lovely. It left me, I wasn't feeling angry. I wasn't in a rage. I wasn't going, oh, Chibnall.
Was it like Chris Chibnall had broken into your house again, but this time to apologise for all the previous times he'd broken into your house?
It's more like he called round when I was out, so he put a note through the door. So, you know, it was okay.
So on your letterbox mark, instead of no hawkers, please, do you have no script editors, please? And I hope you noticed the mention of your hero, Mark.
Oh, yes, I did. That was one of my favourite scenes as well. The scene between Tegan and the Fifth Doctor was really good.
Yeah.
Well, both those scenes, the one with Ace and the Seventh Doctor as well. But Tegan and the Fifth Doctor particularly, and it did genuinely make me sad. When she said, so what am I thinking? He said, Adric.
Yeah.
I just was like, oh, thank you. It just, it was, you know, because it's, as an Adric fan, I get a lot of stick and I have to put up with a lot of people constantly taking the piss out of Adric.
Yeah, Doc.
Yeah. And, but the fact that character's died often seems to just not get mentioned. It's like, oh, yeah, let's just completely forget about that character. So to have it referred to, it's a bit of valediction, and it did touch me. And, you know, these are cheap shots to go for in a way. They're easy. It's low-hanging fruit, I feel.
You think you left and I never thought of you again. I never forget any of you. I remember everything.
Yeah? Well, what am I thinking, seeing all these Cybermen?
Adric.
So I came away from the story feeling happier than normal after a Chris Chibnall episode, which isn't difficult, to be fair. It's a low bar. But I still found myself irritated by some of the dialogue, and I realised what one of my biggest problems of this entire era is, and it disappoints me a bit, actually. But I have to admit to myself now that it's definitely Jodie Whittaker. I don't like Chris Chibnall's version of her, of the Doctor, because they're lacking compassion and they're just generally a dick. I don't like the dialogue the Doctor's given. I don't like Jodie's performance of the dialogue generally. I mean, there's a few stories I really like her in, like Witchfinders and stuff, and I think she's brilliant. And I think she's a lovely person and she's really great when she's doing stuff off the show. But just too much of that explaining voice and the chopping wood hands again. And constantly doing it. And her, the way she delivers explanatory stories. And she starts talking like this. And she says it like this. And I find it quite lifeless. There's no pizzazz into it. It doesn't come out naturally. It doesn't come out with any oomph or charisma. It just feels, I don't know. I don't like her costume. Every other outfit she's been given to wear, she looks better in than her main costume. And I just, like I say, she seems lovely, but I just, and like I said, that version of the character as well, there's no compassion there, is there? There's no, you know, dropping Dan off.
Yeah.
In the middle of the street next to his house that isn't there, and just like going, but it's just like, what? I know if you look at the Fourth Doctor and Sarah Jane, I see him thinking about that, I'd start, that still strikes me as emotional and emotionally satisfying, and it works with those characters, and it makes my tears well up a bit.
They deliberately underplay it, don't they?
Yeah, but that whole thing, like I say, the Chibnall version of that is the 13th Doctor and Dan, and it's just, even her farewell to Yaz, really, it's like, you know, I'm going to do this bit alone, and again, this is another thing, this is another problem I have with Chibnall. He kind of got a lot of people's hopes up who were shipping 13th Doctor and Yasmin. And I think there was a lot of people quite invested in that relationship. And he didn't do it until late on. And then he gets to the final thing and he actually pulls back from it again, doesn't he? So, yeah, I don't like the 13th Doctor. I don't really like Jodie's acting generally, I'm afraid. So, that's, I've got various other things to say. I could keep going. Or do you want to jump in, or shall I keep rolling?
Why doesn't Doc go next?
I got a guilty secret to reveal.
Oh. What, another one?
A secret hate, which I've always kept to myself, because I thought, well, I don't want to become like a hissing and a byword within fandom. But you know, some people will come along and try to shock us by revealing that they hate City of Death.
We've had that one, yeah.
Well, I've hidden it for years, but I'm going to come out now and confess that something which greatly annoys me, truly irritates me, is semi-military radio talk.
Okay.
You know in Dalek, in Series 1, where the Dalek escapes from its cell,
mm-hmm.
and all the soldiers are running around shouting into walkie-talkies,
All guards to converge on the Mellotron cage immediately.
Wall! Red Division, maintain suppressing fire along the perimeter!
And it really annoys me. Can't work out why. But part of the Doctor started out with whoever was in charge of that space train.
Emergency transmission from the Taraji Transport Network. This is an urgent request for immediate assistance.
This is an all-frequency appeal for help. We're under attack. We've been hijacked.
And it really pissed me off right from the start. I do wonder, also, if this is what annoys me with characters like Vender, whose dialogue consists almost entirely of this sort of nonsense. Every line he gets seems to begin with, "This is Instant V Vender reporting from," and it pisses me off. I can't work out why.
Status report. Instant V Vender now exiting the wormhole. I've survived and I'm detecting a light signal from the missing quarries. And the wormhole is playing havoc with the ship. In summary, wormhole navigation was a really bad idea.
And Kate is only a step down from that with her, No line containing the words, "I repeat," should ever be allowed past the script editor stage in Doctor Who. And it genuinely irritates me beyond belief.
Can't you say regards to Vinda? I know what you mean about Vinda. He's got a terrible habit. He spent all that time like leaving messages for Bell, but I don't think he can spend more than 30 seconds standing in a spot without starting to talk out loud to himself.
I know.
Because he's standing there, he's looking at the phone, thinking about ringing the doctor. Rather than actually doing it, he does this big long thing about, "Oh, well, doctor, looks like I'm going to have to ring you up. I've got this phone in my hand now, and I'm going to ring you up with it." So, what are you doing? Just shut up. It's a good job he wasn't, he's hiding on the TARDIS from the master. He suddenly says, "Yes. Right then, master, I'm hiding from you. You don't know I'm here, but I'm going to jump. Oh, no, I've done it again. Hello, this is Vinda. I'm hiding in the master's TARDIS, about to ambush him. Oh, bugger."
It's like when you're hiding from the baddie and you feel you're about to sneeze. but you feel, I've got a bit of self-dialogue coming, coming up. It was another of those cases where I generally enjoyed it on first watching, but what really sabotaged it for me was rewatching it again for the podcast.
As usual.
And taking notes, because it never does any good for me, that sort of thing. I really disliked the opening. I thought, oh, bloody hell. All the banter on top of the hijacked space train. You know, people are in danger, and they're all banter joking about.
Oh yeah!
What a landing! 9.9. Our boots are connected to the electromagnetic roof.
Well, we're literally safe and on a space train.
Shut up, Dad!
I see. I feel just as my jump is better than yours. Yeah.
And and the clunky lines are getting immediately. Our boots are connected to the electromagnetic roof. Now, it strikes me that if the Doctor was regularly using words like that, she would never have ended up with an accent that strong, because you can't get your mouth around words like that. And almost immediately following that, as you just said, I think one of the lads on 42 to Doomsday said that Dan's departure was perhaps the most heartfelt and meaningful exit since Dodo's. I do think that, you know, we mentioned this thing how in one of the behind the sofa extras on the one of the new Blu-ray sets, you've got Sacha Dhawan looking at an old Roger Delgado and saying, oh, isn't it strange? He's really still, isn't he? And calm. And I thought he was quite a bit calmer in this. I've still no idea why Rasputin was going in.
No.
Was it solely to facilitate the song? So you could try and match this, this is a sister's moment from the Sound of Drums?
I thought that would be the nailed-on guaranteed moment that you would have enjoyed, though, Doc.
What, the song?
Bit of Boney M, yeah.
Yeah, Rasputin, yeah.
Oh, I adored the song. I just trying to go, well, what exactly is he doing there? Because there's no other reason why it should be Rasputin, is there? I did like how the song's being sung, how the Dalek and the Cybermen sort of look towards each other and sort of raise eyebrows at each other. Very appropriate song, I thought, with its Chibnall-esque clunky lyrics. You got lines like, what is it?
There was a cat that really was gone.
No, I don't know if that's meant to be cool Black Street talk, so I don't know if I can object to that. But there's lines like...
It's certainly all the talk in the playgrounds when I was a kid in Cardiff.
Most people looked at him with terror and with fear, but to Moscow chicks, he was such a lovely deer. What?
Such a lovely deer.
I do think it's a glorious line, though. The music and the beats. Oh, it just takes me so much. So far back, things like that. Mar Baker. What else did they do?
Daddy Cool?
Daddy Cool, I think I used to like.
Oh, yes, Daddy Cool.
And it's, I must say that when Sasha started doing the dance to it, I enjoyed that. It reminded me very much of Mark throwing shapes at Tayden's wedding. That's really wonderful. Ace and Tegan, I quite liked, actually. I thought some of that line, as you say, I haven't heard from the doctor in nearly 4 days. Oh, show off. Just it's only 3 decades for me.
Yeah.
It's... what? But I thought they were good, generally. And particularly, and this is what I think... I'll get to the good... Because there were good bits for me. Although the Master's a lot calmer now, he's still goofy mad, isn't he? I mean, he had a few truly mean lines like, your dad was an idiot. And how's your auntie Vanessa? Do you keep her in a little doll's house?
That tickled me, actually.
Yeah. But I think one problem is, I think now that it's become accepted that the Master's plots can be as dumb as they like, because his plots, as in his conspiracies, because they don't have to make any sense, it's become a temptation to just do his stories with meaningless overblown plots, with no need to be clever or inventive. I mean, the whole big Dalek drill into the volcano thing was a bit, again? And then I'll solve it by turning the lava into steel, just because I can.
What about the line when Ace says to him, last time I saw you, you were half cat, and he said, well, everyone's allowed to experiment, or something like that. I thought that was good.
Yeah, those exchanges were really good, weren't they? Those were good fun. I know what you mean about the Master's plot. I mean, the thing is, that's essentially the whole point of this episode, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Master's plot. And he's digested the cyber AI, so he's got this incredible tactical brain, and yet he can't work out that, one, he can be kicked out of the TARDIS by Yaz just like that. And two, he doesn't bother checking, securing the TARDIS once she lets him back in. He just goes, oh, right, fine. Oh, what? Oh, you were sorry for what you did? Oh, okay, then. Well, let's go off and do something. What sort of a tactical genius is that? I'm so many steps ahead. And then she just takes him back.
Yeah.
And then, oh, here's a trick hologram. And he's like, oh! Sorry, it's just reminded me of something else. That the doctor says to Yaz about reversing the force regeneration. It's very, you know, something like this. It's very difficult. It's very dangerous and should only be done in extreme circumstances. But it's almost impossible. And Yaz chucks the master into that pod, flashes the sonic screwdriver around, and hey, presto, it's sort of fine. But I don't get the... really don't understand, like you say, one, why he's Rasputin in 1916, other than, like you say, just for the whole, this is a bit to do, you know, adds a bit to the story, perhaps. But there doesn't seem to be any point to it. But his entire plan, I mean, I don't understand how a forced regeneration works in the context that they use it in this story. How they say, oh, I'm going to force you to regenerate into me. It's like, what? Also, why? I mean, I'm not being funny, but there's literally no difference All Sacha Dhawan has to do is kill the Doctor. Just kill the Doctor, and then there's got to be an easier way to do it. And if he wants to just swan around in her clothes and her TARDIS, he can do anyway. There's no point. The whole forced regeneration thing doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know. I suppose he thinks he's wiping her out completely. But the forced regeneration just doesn't make sense. How can you... I'm going to make you regenerate into me. It's just one of those bits that just...
Well, can I have you saying this? If he wants to change into Jodie's Doctor, he can just put her clothes on? Because people will think that you're criticising Eddie Izzard. But I think the best thing about Segan and Ace, I didn't think they were particularly amazing when they were just on their own together, but they're getting to meet their own doctors via the Doctor's AI sort of hollow me thing. And I think one of the good things, which worked with also the other doctors in robes on the cliff, is that they seem to have said, actually, we can do a big special episode, multiple doctors on now, without having to do every single one of them. It can not really matter that Tom's not there or that the post-TV movie doctors aren't there. And in the same way that in the support group at the end, Annika isn't there, Polly rather. And you notice on the spare seat in that circle of where they were sitting around, he had a laptop on it.
Yeah.
So you literally could imagine that all the other companions were Skyping in or Zooming in quite like that. But I think that this AI HoloMe thing was something that was really inventive, because it was a bit like, do you remember in Matt Smith's Doctor's Era? What was his term? The Doctor's Wife or something? He's semi-unconscious, conscious or something in the TARDIS console room. And this little, was it the little girl who...
In Let's Kill Hitler, yeah.
Yeah, and she was appearing as this sort of hologram that the TARDIS had chosen as its interface.
Oh, right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I think that works really well, because then you can avoid the potential ridiculousness of Peter or Sylvester turning up in versions of their old costumes, which make them just look very old and very, should we say, less slim. If you've got it like a flickering hologram, you can make up for that sort of thing. I thought that Colin and Sylvester and Peter looked amazing in those robes.
Mm.
And ironically, I did think that Paul McGann not being in the robes really made him look his age. In the way that the others didn't. I thought, God, he's looking old, isn't he? So I like that. I also like things that you think, you genuinely think, oh, of course. Because once you're doing that whole thing about, you give me an electric shock, it would have been obvious that something was happening. But I was getting annoyed by it. Then you find out, oh, that's how she's given them the AI thing. A bit like the Russian doll turning out to the Cyberman. It's done in plain sight, and that you should forget it. And I do think that Arshad is the best thing about the Cybermen they've done in New Who. His physical movement is lovely at times, and makes such a nice change while the bloody stomping.
Will you long ago develop resistance to gold?
Yeah, it looks like there's actually a human in there rather than it being just a robot, isn't there?
Yes,
I think, which is what the Cybermen's supposed to be. And also, I'm not a big fan of the Cybermasters, really. The Time Lord, sort of.
No. With their doilies on their shoulders.
Mm.
And so all that sort of stuff made up for a lot of the nonsense, to be honest. This enormous unit skyscraper somehow seemed to be built in the back street of some little market town, as opposed to the middle of London.
No, that's a street in Cardiff, because you know when that road where the Doctor comes back and picks up Tegan and Kate Stewart after the unit building's just collapsed, there's a building behind them that I recognise from the streets of Cardiff. So it's filmed in Cardiff, as usual.
I really enjoyed Graham suddenly turning up out of the blue in the middle of the volcano.
Yeah.
Because he's been one of my favourite probably character of this era.
Yes.
But otherwise, no, I just enjoyed everything. I did think, as she regenerated into Tennant, and he said his first what, I thought, oh no, Hayden is going to be unbearable. I'm getting it right.
This is why I've gone last.
Previously on Diddly-Dum.
I mean, I think Jodie's going to regenerate into him. The episode will end with, what? 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 And then that'll be the end of the episode.
I know these teeth. What? What?
Fire away, Hayden.
Well, I think there's been moments during this era when I've arguably hated it more than you two. Because it's just been, in a sense, actually, it's been quite soul-destroying. It's like watching something which you've always known and loved wane and not be as good as it used to be. It's like watching your heroes grow old.
Yeah.
It's like going back to a program you haven't seen or listening to a song that you haven't listened to in decades and then realising actually it's crap.
It's like seeing Lou Reed with the Velvet Underground at Glastonbury in the 1990s, quite possibly something you love, and it's, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And you can't even enjoy hating it, can you?
No, because it feels bad, and it feels like it's a waste of time, really, because it's one of those things where it's like what Mark was saying about Jodie's character. Jodie's character wasn't going to change in the last episode magically to something which was to someone who was more empathetic, someone who was more caring. So you just kind of have to accept that this Doctor is lacking those social tools.
Mm.
As is Chris Chibnall as a writer, you know his deficiencies at this point, so you know that some of the dialogue is going to be clunky. You do know there's going to be quite a lot of hopping from one place to another to add scale to the story when it doesn't actually add that much, I thought. It just doesn't add anything to the story for me. So I went into it with extreme trepidation, a bit like how you'd feel before you go in for an operation on an ingrowing toenail. Knowing things are going to be better after this, but you're probably going to be quite sore and this is going to hurt.
It's like a visit to the dentist. You're like, no, I don't want to do it.
This is going to hurt for the next few hours or whatever. And I was really worried as well because, like you've both been saying, you know, Tegan and Ace, they obviously haven't been on screen, especially in the case of Janet Field, and they haven't acted on screen in nearly 40 years. You know, Sophie Aldrey, a little less time. Obviously, she has worked on a lot of children's programmes. Even up until the last few years, she's been on programmes a bit on CBeebies. So, but you've not seen them act with the kind of weight and the drama that Doctor Who requires in that time. So I was a bit worried about that. And I don't listen to Big Finish, so I don't want nothing to base anything on. So there's just a bit of trepidation there. And there was just the feeling of me sort of almost on my knees praying to Chris Chibnall saying, just please make this passable. Because I didn't mind Eve of the Daleks, that was okay, but Legend of the Sea Devils was so poor. It left me on the floor. And it was the Doctor Who equivalent for me to the Champions League final in 2019. Where I felt directionless and thinking, why am I following this team? Why am I watching this programme? You know, and I just thought, even though RTD is coming back, even though Tennant is back as well, you know, they weren't eras, as I've said before, that I was that fond of, really. Even though I was very excited about Shooty starting. So I accepted it for what it was going to be, and I kind of left my baggage at the door. And about 90 minutes later, I sort of reeled in my seat thinking, I don't think I've enjoyed an episode of Doctor Who that much in years. So I really liked it. And I know I said to you chaps, a little bit behind the scenes here, ladies and gentlemen, but I actually messaged my colleagues here and I did tell them that I wasn't going to watch it again because I didn't want it to dampen my enjoyment of the programme. Because I remember when we all watched Rosa back in the day and we all thought, oh, that's amazing. Yeah. And then on the second watch, all four of us at the time, all went, we found some problems with it. You know, and it sort of spoiled the fun. But I've watched it four times.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in the last 2 weeks.
What, for like a laugh? Or what, for pleasure?
Yeah, for pleasure.
Wow.
The thing is, we can't not rewatch it, because if we when we reviewed on this podcast, we'd all be saying, oh, amazing, wasn't it? Which bits did you enjoy? Oh, I can't really remember anything, really.
Hey, look, listeners, I know that we're one of the most refrigerated takes that comes out in podcast land. But I would like to say that if you heard our hot takes, they just imagine we've done them and they're all fairly enthusiastic. And just like, well, that was all right, wasn't it? That was a bit of fun. That was all right for a bit of Sunday night telly, bit of sci-fi, bit of fun, a little bit of cheesy Doctor Who. I had a bit of fun with it. That was all right. That's what our hot takes would probably be.
Yeah.
It's only when we go back to it that the facade shatters and we start picking amongst the pieces and go, oh, God.
Yeah. But it's the nature of the job as well, you know. We podcast on Doctor Who and we review the new episodes. Well, we review episodes anyway. So it's what we're going to do. We are going to pick it apart. For me, I think the vast majority of the problems with it are in the first act. In that first bit up until the Master becomes the Doctor, that's where a lot of the problems I have with it sit. For me, so I'll start with the negatives. Dan, arguably, I mean, people say he got the worst send-off since Dodo. I think he may have the worst send-off since Chameleon. I just think it's just... Because the Doctor... I mean, he seems to acknowledge that she is angry with him. I was like, oh, is she all right? Have I upset her? She takes him back outside Anfield, which who wants that? To where his house used to be but no longer is.
I mean, you could say it's almost... Never mind Chameleon and Dodo. You argue that, by comparison, Katerina was sent off with a warm hug.
I like to think that after Dan left, the 13th Doctor turned around to Yaz and went, don't worry, and she pulled a big box out and said, Dan Mark II on it.
And it's voiced by a different actor.
I've got one who can act.
Yeah.
But in the past, the Doctor has left winning lottery tickets, vintage sports cars and fully paid off houses to their companions.
Psychic paper just to the last couple.
Psychic paper to Graham, yeah, exactly. So it's like, you know, what did Dan ever do to to upset this Doctor? But it would have been, structurally for the programme, it would have been a problem if he was there, because he would have funked up the scenes with Yaz on the TARDIS, and he couldn't convincingly do what Vinda needed to do. Which was basically...
Wasn't the actor busy as well?
No, that's the main reason, apparently. Yeah, John Bishop was unavailable to film most of it. I think the train scene I read was directed... I can't remember who did the directing on Legend of the Sea Devils, I'm sorry. But that train scene was filmed in that block.
I wonder if John Bishop thought I'd delivered enough Chibnall dialogue for one lifetime. Thank you very much.
You know, when I say don't bring your work home with you, well, he's going home and people are getting fed up of his clunky dialogue to them. So he's just thinking, oh, I better get out of here before.
Yeah. No, Doctor, don't come back for me. Just go. These scripts are awful. Please spare me, Doctor. I'm a professional actor. I shouldn't be doing this.
You think someone's a comedian? I thought the train sequence was exciting, but yeah. This was it. This was the funny thing. The music was really loud in the mix, which I had to alter the sound on my TV to put it to personal, I think it was, instead of movie, I think it was set to. And it was still pretty loud for that segment. So my enjoyment of that was...
Yeah, I missed loads of dialogue in that scene, which I didn't realise how much I missed until I put the subtitles on for the... when I was taking my notes.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay.
There was a lot going on. But I liked Dan's reasoning for leaving. And we'd never really seen, well, okay, apart from Dodo, we've never really seen a companion leave right at the start of a story. Well, it wasn't right at the start of Dodo, but you know what I mean? We'd never seen a companion leave right at the start of a story before. This was new territory. But it gave Yaz and the Doctor space to sort of breathe together, doing the whole unravelling.
And how cruel to take him back to Anfield at the end of the Klopp era.
I know, that's terrible, isn't it? I wonder if he went back at the 7-2 against Aston Villa. That would have been hilarious.
Yeah, it's funny because she picked him up when Liverpool were flying high, and now she's dumped him off with no house and Liverpool struggling.
Yeah.
Cheers, great Doctor, thanks a lot.
Yeah, and I thought the moment the talk between Tegan and Ace could have done with another draft, I think, or two. Some of Kate Stewart's lines. There was a line that she said, what was it, the nice new place you've got here or something. And then Kate Stewart says, thank you. And you'd have thought like there would have been a joke about that, as if to say, I don't know, this is really naff. But she may have said after that, oh yeah, it's going to be a while before I pay the mortgage off on this or something like that. I don't know, something weird like that. But it was such a nowhere line. It was like, it didn't need to be there. It literally didn't. I mean, I'm not to the level of obviously Chris Chibnall, but I am a writer. I am a writer as well. And one of the things I've been doing recently is going through my latest book and editing it to hell. And like lines like that have just been deleted straight away. It means nothing to the story, means nothing to where you want to go with your characters. It's just such a throwaway line. Throwaway lines are fine when they're humorous, I think. But they're not good when they're just taking up airtime, especially on like nearly a 90-minute special. So that was clunky. Ace and Tegan were fine for me. They felt like, I think because their acting style did seem to resemble how they would have, well, how they acted when they were in the show back in the 80s, it made me feel like there was a familiarity with the characters. And with the Master as well. I mean, the Master, funnily enough for me, I don't like the batshit crazy Joker kind of Master that John Sim had in his episodes with I liked him when he came back in The Doctor Falls, but I didn't like him with David Tennant because it was too manic. It was trying to sort of mirror the 10th Doctor. Whereas I think Sacha Dhawan does a better version of that, but it's Sacha Dhawan's quieter moments, which are there, amazingly. You'll find them after, you know, four times of watching the episode. They are there. There's quieter moments there. There's more slightly subtle moments which bring the Master back down again. And he did that in previous episodes with Jodie's Doctor, so that was fine with me. But the yes, you in the beard.
people often say that the Master's like a reverse image of the Doctor. So what would have been great is if we'd have seen bits in the story where Sacha Dhawan, once he's got the TARDIS and the Doctor, turning up in Liverpool and buying down a house, maybe going round to Graham's house with some flowers and chocolates and saying, I'm really glad to hear about your test results, man. That's really good. And stuff like that. And that's what the boss, ha ha, take that, Doctor. I foiled your heartless ways.
That'd be brilliant. Yeah, that'd be excellent. And then coming back to saying to Sarah Jane, I'm sorry I left you in Aberdeen, not Croydon. That kind of thing. Yeah, that would have been nice. That would have been brilliant. But he's got form for this batshit craziness. And it was yourself, Mark, who pointed it out to me. And ever since then, I'm far more forgivable for what the Master does. When you said about how he's addicted to the thrill of being mad and stuff.
This goes back to the Dr. Falls podcast, doesn't it? When John Sim's character is so addicted to evil, he can't give it up. Whereas a Missy's actually managed to quit.
Yeah, exactly. But this is a Master who there's a huge amount of self-loathing there. You know, he even says, oh, don't let me be me again. You know, he would literally go as far as taking over the Doctor's body not to be the Master anymore. In his own weird, incredible way, he wants to be liked. He wants to be somebody else, but he can't stop doing what he does. And he's got form for stuff like, you know, dressing up as Rasputin or being Rasputin. This is a character who, in an episode of The Mark of the Rani, he's a scarecrow in a field for however long, it's a tree as well, isn't he, at one point or something.
It's the best one's time flight, isn't it?
He's a weird shaman, yeah.
Dressed up as that guy for no reason whatsoever.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So he's got form for this. So when you're reminded of that and you do think, oh yeah, he's completely off the boil, you think, okay, well, I can forgive that. But it was after he'd taken the Doctor's body over, Yaz comes into her own in a way. You know, we've been told since, I think, Sierra is 12, how special Yaz is. and how brilliant Yaz is. Well, for me, she's not really shown it until now. You know, the fact that it's understandable that she would have notes on how to pilot the TARDIS. You know, this is the person who sat in the TARDIS for months waiting for the Doctor to come back at the start of Revolution. No, was it Revolution? No, Resolution. Oh, God, I'm forgetting them now. The one with Captain Jack in it. When the Doctor's in prison for a
Resolution.
At the start of it. So she's obviously been studying up there. And she's travelled with the Doctor for a long time. She's been the mainstay of this incarnation. And I did think it was Mandip Gill's probably her best episode. There's a lot that she did towards the end where she just didn't say anything and just conveyed a lot of emotions with her. Yes, you and the beard.
Sorry to interrupt. I absolutely 100% agree with you. I know I don't know if I've really complained about the actress so much as the character. Mm. Almost constantly throughout the series, I've complained about the character of Yaz, at least. And I agree, this one, she had far more to do. Admittedly, she's being guided by holographic AI, but whatever. She did loads. And I think Mandip really showed some top-notch acting chops. I thought she was really good. You could see her breaking in those final scenes with the Doctor. You could actually see her, like, crump, like, heartbreaking. And like you say, there's no, that was without dialogue. It was just looks in her face. And I think there's a bit when, I think it's the bit where the Doctor says, I'm going to have to do this alone. You can see Mandy like takes this huge swallow as if she's like, that really hurts. Well, I'm just going to swallow it down and let it fester inside me. And you can see it, she looks dazed as she's walking out of the TARDIS, which is why it's so nice to have that last scene, because it takes her away from that and it gives her a softer landing. Mm. Which otherwise, if you hadn't have had Graham doing that scene and all those companions back, that would have been a dreadful way for the Doctor to say goodbye to Yaz.
Yeah.
You know, not even like a hug. Or was there a hug?
No, there wasn't. No.
Yeah. I thought Mandip was her performance. There are several bits in this as well. The bit where the Doctor says to her, you wait here, and Yaz just goes, nope. And walks straight into the Master's TARDIS behind her. Yeah, really good. Fair play to Mandip, and indeed to Yaz. Yeah. This was easily her best episode and the character's best episode.
Hmm. Absolutely. And I think with the supporting cast as well, I liked what Kate Stewart had to do here. I thought Gemma Redgrave did quite a bit of fair stuff. Mark's shaking his head at me. And he's put me off my
Sorry.
I thought she was all right. I thought she was okay. But I think of the two, I think Tegan and Ace had... Or should I say Tego and Ace? They had a lot to do.
Yeah.
But it was interesting how I thought Tegan's thread and what she had to do, for me, reminded me of bits of Earthshock when she's on her own and she's trying to get to the freighter bridge and everything, where she's felt to me a bit like when she was in the thing. I know Janet Fielding on Twitter said... to anyone, like when she falls down the shaft, like how does she survive? Just but she bounces. But I sort of took it as being maybe she just let go of a rung and then caught another rung when she was further down past the fire of the Cybermen. I don't know, but that was a minor detail in a lot of stuff that was already going on. But I love the moment when Ace parachuted off the roof and then that camera angle following her down on the parachute.
I love that too.
Into the TARDIS where... she was on like a gurney or something and she was going in, which then explains why as the gravity alters, she then tips up the right way. I really, really liked that. And I loved her interaction with Graham for something which I thought a two-hander bit between two characters who'd never met before. I thought, oh, careful here, Chibnall. But actually, I thought this was really good.
Yes.
I'm Ace. Oh, yes, you are. You know, is he going to follow us off after her? Yeah, really good.
Bradley Walsh, even though he had very few lines, again, just lovely, lovely performance. Just a delight to see him in it.
Yeah, I don't care that, you know, what was he doing in the volcano? I liked that he was there. I liked that we had those moments with him. I love the moment when they're doing that Journey's End moment around the console. And they're all standing there and he goes, can we let go yet? At the very end of them, the moment when they've sent the sort of the metal planet into present day to start.
Well, they're lucky they didn't have Captain Jack in that scene, aren't they? Otherwise, can we let go yet would be meaning something very different, quite possibly.
Indeed. Oh, indeed. The bits with the Doctors, with the previous Doctors, were genuinely lovely.
Mm.
And I thought, this is actually quite special. I went back recently and watched Twice Upon a Time again because I really enjoyed Paul Cornell's novelization of it. And it lent a little bit, it sort of explained a bit of it to me and made me feel a bit better about that story. So I went back and rewatched it. And if you ignore the silly bits that Stephen Mark, well, I should call him Steve, my pal Steve, put into that story about, you know, jolly good smack bottom and women are only good for one thing and where's Polly when you need her and all that kind of stuff. If you ignore all of that, Bradley's not that bad. It's just sometimes the stilted delivery of him in that one. And he didn't do that this time, and he was so much more the First Doctor. I thought, how lovely is it that we've got someone who can be the First Doctor in something that is representing, you know, the full cycle of it, with, you know, Ian Cheston obviously later on. And, you know, the fact they were older and in robes. Stephen Moffat said the reason why he couldn't put them in Day of the Doctor was because he felt it, they would look stupid being in their old costumes. So this was a brilliant way of having, you know, street part of the Doctor's consciousness. It's incarnations who are almost sort of they are gatekeepers. And then even when Peter Davison and Sylvester McCoy appear later on in their costumes, they didn't look silly at all. You know, really didn't. No. And the fifth Doctor and Tegan scene made me a little emotional because Peter Davison was the First Doctor I saw. You know, I saw Paul McGann, obviously, in a TV movie, but that felt so separate to everything else at that point. The actual sort of classic Doctor Who, as it were. Peter Davison was the first one I saw, and Tegan was the first companion, along with Nyssa, that I saw. So I got a real feeling of nostalgia there. But when it was the seventh Doctor and Ace, I thought some of the lines in that bit were just lovely. You know, the bit about the real joy is watching you fly. You know, and even the bit at the end, which could have been corny, especially, and I hate to say this because I do like Sylvester McCoy, but could have been corny in his hands, but the bit which says, "I said we're all right then. Oh, we're better than all right. We're Ace." You know, that could have...
Yes.
Can I just say, isn't it funny how... Sorry, I just dived in. I didn't even put my hand up. Isn't it funny how like Chris Chibnall seems to be absolutely unable to write two human beings talking to each other in a normal sense, but get him to do something like that between the Doctor and the companion. And it comes out lovely.
It does. It does. And I actually shed a tear during the seventh and Ace scene.
Well, I welled up. I rewatched it with Mrs. Kelly, and she, every time Ace appeared on the screen, Mrs. Kelly started welling up. And it's because she used to watch it. I mean, she's a fairly casual Doctor Who viewer, as you know, we obviously, I've been watching with them over the years. But I think it was because it reminded her of when she was a kid. She used to watch it round to her grandparents' house.
Yeah.
And so there was suddenly that weird, you know, life in this country is difficult for some people at the moment. And I think there's a lot of negative stuff going on. Mm. And I think it just, I think there was that conversation Tom Baker had with that homeless guy, wasn't there? Homeless guy was like, "Oh my God, you've just reminded me of when I was happy." And Ace appearing on television did that for Mrs. Kelly, I think. Although it's funny because she said, so I watched Sylvester McCoy, but after that I stopped watching because I've never seen Colin Baker. I said, no, Colin Baker was between. Aww. She went, that's weird, because I watched Peter Davison and I watched Sylvester McCoy. I must have just...
He was a favourite of Jodie Whittaker's on set because he called her boss.
Oh, I've heard that, yes.
Colin Baker called her boss on set. So, yeah. So he apparently really put her at ease with that because they did a day with David Bradley, Sylvester McCoy and Colin Baker doing their bits, with Sophie Aldred standing in for the Doctor at certain points, apparently. She was reading some of the lines to them off camera in the moments when Jodie had to be somewhere else. And then she did Peter and Paul on the other days. Paul McGann, I thought, again, looked brilliant. But I read a weird statistic, which is this was Paul McGann's debut in Doctor Who proper, 26 years after he made his debut as the Eighth Doctor.
Hold on. But isn't the TV movie, doesn't that have a production code?
I don't think it does. No, it's its own separate thing. Oh, and then obviously Night of the Doctor as well. So now this is actually the first time he's made it. And the other thing was David Bradley's appeared in Doctor Who twice, and it's been regeneration stories both times as well, which is interesting. But I love those bits. And the companions roundtable bit. That, and also Kate Stewart potentially enlisting... Well, no, she says, "I'm enlisting people who set a unit up again, and I need people with experience of fighting aliens," you know. Brilliant ideas that Big Finish must have just absolutely creamed their pants over. Because they must be like, oh, we've got this whole new thing that we can do. And it's a great idea. And it's a really good way now. Because I don't know why we haven't really done this before much. I know we've had, obviously, Sarah Jane and Captain Jack every now and then and River Song. But it is odd why the companions haven't made more of an appearance. Older companions, you know.
Yeah.
Because when you look at it, I mean, I think Sophie Aldred was brilliant. I think Janet Fielding, I really liked her as well. But I thought Ace was still so proactive. She was still that same character from the 80s. Tegan kind of was as well, actually, I should say.
Mm.
And even seeing people like, you know, Bonnie Langford coming back, she's a better actress now than what she was when she was in the show. I mean, you could have these people making reappearances every now and then.
They do the Blu-ray trailers as well, don't they?
Exactly, which are supposedly canon, according to RTD, I think he said. So that's, you know, don't know, I think it was Instagram I read that on. I might be wrong. No, but I just loved it. And see Ian Chesterton as well. My youngest sister is one of those who's completely fallen away. She fell away at the end of Matt Smith, gone on board to watch Peter Capaldi's Regeneration, really fell away with Jodie Whittaker, but I told her to watch this. And she was texting me. I was asleep, so it was just like a running transcript of her live comments, what she's doing. And she sent me three pictures of her, like really tearful. And the moments that she got tearful was when she saw Ace for the first time, because she really liked Seven and Ace. She loved Remembrance of the Daleks when she was really little, when she was about six or seven. That and The Five Doctors were the two stories that were always missing from my cabinet. And they were in her bedroom instead of mine because she wanted to watch them. So it was that moment. It was the companions around the table. And it was seeing the old doctors again. And she was just a blubbering mess for all of them. And she's got... So she's always loved Sylvester McCoy. Also because he's in The Hobbit as well. She loves The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings.
That's where the Kelly girls knew him from, was the Hobbit films. They go, oh, it's Radagast.
He's a fairly successful actor when you think about it now. You know, he's quite well known. Going off on a tangent quickly, there was a moment in Connie Huck's documentary about children's TV recently.
I saw that the other day. That's quite good, though.
Yeah. And someone says, when they're talking about Vision On, they say, we had all sorts of people. Even Sylvester McCoy was in it for a bit. And they show a clip of Sylvester McCoy. Because he's a big celebrity now, you know. And Shooty Gatwell obviously likes him too.
Yes.
He, you know, left that message and stuff. So he's really appealing to the younger audience, you know, still. So she was really... And I should have said the moment with Seven and Ace as well. She was just absolutely bawling her eyes out at that. And she said, I just cannot wait to see what happens next now. Even if David Tennant hadn't have turned up at the end, she said it was just brilliant. And I actually thought the regeneration bit was brilliant. I loved it. I thought the music and the camera panning away from, Dangly Door. I can't remember what it's called.
Oh, Durdle.
Durdle Door. I've been there as well, and I can't remember what it's called. It was a gorgeous, gorgeous moment. Really, really lovely. And I liked her dialogue. I liked the, you know, tag you're it. I didn't like the moment. I thought there was a teeny tiny bit of showrunner putting a bit of himself in there, or potentially when he said, yeah. Oh, I want to know what happens next, or there's, you know, and that sort of thing.
Mm. A bit like when Stephen Moffat put in, Doctor, I'll Let You Go.
Yeah. That's it, yeah. But otherwise, of the new series, it's second only in regeneration stories to Parting of the Ways for me.
Gosh!
Well, I'd still like to think of the Doctor Falls as being Capaldi's actual regeneration story, in a way. But
things might have been different there, yeah. Yeah, even though I like Twice Upon a Time redeemed itself a bit, but it's still not, unfortunately, anywhere near the level, yeah.
Can I just say, with regards to Chibnall putting a little bit in the script, as a, like, this is a message from the showrunner, there's a bit where Jodie sat talking to Yaz on the TARDIS, and she says... you know why it's sad? It's sad because everything that's gone before it has been so,
I know,
so very special. And I've written on my notes from the second time I was watching it, it's not been special. Goodbye!
Mark, what did the Mrs. Kelly think of it?
Well, Mrs. Kelly loved it. She said, I really quite enjoyed that. And that was one of the best Chris Chibnall episodes I think I've seen. Way better than any others. And the oldest Kelly daughter, who is now 11, she sat there on her pad doing other stuff And she never really looks continuously at the screen for more than about 10 seconds until the Rah-Rah Rasputin came on. And she was like, oh, I love this song. It's amazing.
It is a tune, to be fair. It is a tune.
But apart from that, she ignored most of it. And the smallest, Caitlin, who's 8, she watched it and enjoyed it, was quite happy about it. And then we had a little talk about Doctor Who afterwards, and she got upset when I mentioned her. Because I was trying to explain to her who the new Doctor was. And I said, don't you remember Rose? And she went, oh, no. Because she remembers Doomsday very well. Because she accidentally watched it twice once. And the second time round, she was sitting there next to her mum going, oh, Mum, why did you let me watch this again? Yes, so she fairly enjoyed it. And I think they don't seem to really remember who David Tennant is. But I think there's more chance of them watching it when the new series comes back now. Everyone seemed a little bit more enthused about the show afterwards than they had done at any point for the last... how many years has it been now? 4?
5. Is it since she started? 4 or 5, yeah.
5.
How did girls that age know about Boney M?
Ah, 2 reasons. One, it was on a game called Just Dance that was on the Nintendo Wii.
Oh, right.
Because that's how my sisters are.
They'll know it from that.
Also, someone remixed it last year and it went to number 1.
Oh, right.
But the remix sounded pretty much identical to the original song, I have to say. But it charted again last year, yeah.
Okay. I think it was also something because they do dance. They go to dance class, so they would have had that in their dance class, which are a little inappropriate for young ladies of that age, surely, to sing about Russia's greatest love machine.
Well, as long as they're not saying, oh, we can't wait to watch Shooty, we like him in Sex Education.
My favourite line in that song, I think, is the one where it's a kind of a resigned... It was a shame how he carried on. can I just put in my last bit? One thing I will say for Chris Chibnall is I mentioned to Mrs. Kelly, I said to her, yeah, this is probably the best episode since that Weepy Angels one, isn't it? And she said, oh, no, it's better than that. And she said, because we've seen all that Weeping Angels stuff before. Everything that was in that Weeping Angels episode, we've pretty much seen before, you know, apart from the cliffhanger, obviously. You know, it was angels crowding people into a small space, and it didn't really add anything. But that's the thing with Chris Chibnall, isn't it? If somebody's had a good idea, then Chris Chibnall hates not to use it, even if it's himself. He hates not to reuse a good idea, even if it's one that he's had himself just a few months earlier.
Yeah.
Like, Jodie transported as a monster. She gets turned into a weeping angel, and then, oh, she turned into a weeping angel. I know, so it's just to move her over here. She's fine. And getting that Dalek, and she gets in the Dalek, and then, oh, the Dalek closes around her, and she's been turned into it's just to move her over to here. She's fine. So that's the same thing. I mean, I don't know how much of this is deliberate, or if it's just unconscious, or if it's supposed to be fan service, but...
Yeah, in places.
Like Tegan saying, we used to be you. That's just Rose and Sarah Jane all over again, isn't it? Sasha's master is basically John Sims' master.
Yes.
Including even the bit where he's dancing round to a pop song with an incapacitated doctor, which John Sims' master did. Monsters shooting themselves as well. That's another thing. He only did that in Evolution of Daleks, where I'm surrounded by Daleks. Oh, I ducked, and they shot themselves. And this time, that ridiculous thing where these creatures with all these sensors, these Cybermen with all these sensors and things on them, can't tell a difference between a hologram. Like, they must be able to pick up heat suits. They can't tell the difference between a hologram and a physical person. And they all stand round in a circle and then shoot themselves. Also, that's the thing, isn't it? Oh, yeah, Jo Martin's in this as well. What's she doing? She's a hologram.
Yeah.
It's not actually her doctor. Oh, right, okay. I just find Jo Martin's doctor really unsatisfactory in a way, like the way she's been treated and used, and I think used as a cheap credit token.
Yeah.
Yes, because they know that there's a sudden area of fandom who will go wild, ecstatic every time she appears on the screen, despite...
I think so.
Yeah.
Having had a screen time of about 10 minutes in total.
Yeah. And then there's all the companions flying the TARDIS. I suppose that's a deliberate throwback, is it?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously Ace battering a Dalek is. yeah, anyway, that was just a point I wanted to make. It's just, he seems to, like I say, some of it clearly is fan service, but I think a lot of it's just, I still think he can be a bit lazy.
Hmm. What do we think about Tennant's clothes?
We'll find out more in the next one, won't we?
It does suggest it's not a real regeneration, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a suspicion. I think this whole calling him the 14th Doctor's a bit of a red herring, yeah.
Oh, yes, they have started calling him the 15th now, haven't they, Shooty?
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
And so Tennant the 14th, so...
Mind you, I think once you start calling a Doctor a number, it's very hard to take that away and go, oh, we were only joking.
Did we notice that Elon Musk's Twitter revolution is already starting to harm people? You know how they're saying that charging £8 to buy your little blue verification tick, people won't bother buying it anymore. Well, someone has already taken over Ian Levine's identity on Twitter, haven't they? Did you read his review?
No, what was it like?
Doctor Who surpassed every expectation. Don't know that anybody can top that. So incredible, I'm speechless. Not only did I vote 10 out of 10, but it moved me and made me cry. To give a cameo to 97-year-old Ian Chesterton, who was part of my 10-year-old adoration of Doctor Who, was fab.
Wow.
Now, I don't know who it is there that's pretending to be Ian, but clear off, all right?
I've got to verify this now. I'm going to search. Hopefully I won't come across the porn star with the same name.
Yeah, I'm CS explaining to Sophie. I'm sorry, Sophie, you won't believe who I was genuinely looking for.
You've got it on record now. You just have to wait for Doc to edit it, and then she'll get the real story.
You mentioned Gemma Redgrave earlier. I thought she was a bit... I was shaking my head while you were talking about her, because I thought, I don't know if this is the way that she's portrayed. I don't think I've seen Gemma Redgrave in a lot of stuff. I can't think of anything else I've seen her in. But in this, she seems very one note. And I don't know if that's a deliberate thing. Mm. Like, I am the Brigadier's daughter, and I'm going to do this and this and this. And I'm very stoic. Mm. And but she doesn't display a great deal of range, which I think may be what the character's supposed to be like, I don't know. But she's all very matter of fact a lot of the time. Oh, I'm just going to do this. Anyway, sorry, enough of my nigga. I have to get a few kicks in at the end, don't I? I'm such a...
I was really trying to end it on a high, and then Mark comes in and just...
With a two-footed challenge.
After the whistle's blown.
Yeah.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
Marks out of 10.
Marks out of 10. Go on, Doc. What's your mark out of 10, then?
I would give it a 7.5.
Nice. Marco?
I'll give it... Do you know, as Chibnall stories go, this is like a 9er. But in the pantheon of all the stories, it's probably about 3. No, I was joking. That's just a bit of comedy for you there. I give it 6.5.
Forget the final whistle analogy. You're literally Cesc Fabregas throwing pizza at Alex Ferguson right now. In the tunnel.
I'm throwing pizza at Chris Chibnall in the tunnel.
Getting him back for all the times he painted you as a zebra. It's 8.5 for me.
Ooh.
I was going to give it an 8, but when Doc gave it 7.5, I thought, God, I'm going to have to up this a bit just to make him seem more negative than he actually has been.
I'm going to give it a 10.
Oh, he's going to have to give it a 15 now.
No, I think 8 or 8.5. Oh, no. Oh, it's got to be 8.5. 8.5.
Is this Uncle Terrence coming down the corridor to say goodbye to us? Oh, no. It's the old soothsayer. Old soothsayer, have you got something to say to us?
Sooth! Sooth! I've been looking into the fire and seeing what's in store for the rest of Doctor Who. Would you like to see?
Yes, please.
All right, gather around the fire, lads.
Oh, no, I'll look away. I don't like spoilers.
Blue, blue, blue! Blue, 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 blue! Blue, blue, blue! Oh! Wait, there's a vision in the fire.
I can't hear you, I can't hear you.
Let's have a closer look. I see Russell T Davis with Mercy's ears on. He's swimming in money. And he's opening a briefcase. And there's a single piece of paper in it. And it says, bring back David Tennant, all is forgiven. No, it's a t-shirt, not a piece of paper. Pauline Quirk will be the next Doctor, I see.
I understand you've got a job with the National Trust, being a caretaker at Durdle Door. Have you got any advice for our listeners?
Yeah, don't dive into the sea. Don't dive bomb bodies into Durdle Door.
Old soothsayer, old soothsayer. We have teenage divers on the south coast.
It's a trap.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye, everybody. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dun Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydunpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dun. On Twitter at diddly_dun, or email us at diddlydunpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum is liquid podcasting. Stick it in your ear, old sunshine.